content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the November 13, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Obama puts U.S. boots on the ground in Syria. What happened? President Obama confirmed plans to expand U.S. involvement in the Syrian civil war last week, announcing the deployment of up to 50 Special Forces troops to advise local militias fighting the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The escalation, which breaks Obama's repeated insistence that the U.S. should not put boots on the ground in the war-torn country, follows Russian President Vladimir Putin's decision to bolster forces of his beleaguered ally, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, with 4,000 troops, 40 fighter planes and helicopters, and other equipment. White House officials said U.S. soldiers wouldn't play a direct combat role at this time, but acknowledged that they may find it necessary to fight in the future. Their mission is to assist and advise the Kurdish People's Protection Force, which in recent weeks has advanced to within 30 miles of Raqqa, ISIS's de facto capital. Obama's announcement came as all the major foreign players involved in the Syrian conflict met for peace talks in Vienna. Neither the Syrian government nor opposition groups were invited, but both sides were represented by their main patrons, Russia and Iran, which favor keeping Assad in power, and the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, which want him to step down. Also involved in the talks were countries in Europe and the Middle East struggling with a massive influx of Syrian refugees. While the meeting produced no progress on the key issue of Assad's future, the parties agreed to meet for further talks next week. 4.5 years of war, we all believe, has been far too long, said Secretary of State John Kerry. The time has come to stop the bleeding and start the building. What the editorial said. The Special Forces deployment marks another awkward milestone in Obama's foreign policy, said the New York Daily News. The president has repeatedly denied the need for boots on the ground in Syria, saying the U.S. cannot afford to become enmeshed in another Middle East war. Now he's dipping an ankle in the water. It's hard to avoid the conclusion the commander-in-chief is making this up as he goes. What's the point of sending a mere 50 soldiers into a chaotic war zone, said the Wall Street Journal. The Pentagon has given Obama several military options that could dramatically alter the course of the war, including a no-fly zone and the deployment of Apache attack helicopters. This is nothing but a White House attempt to respond to its Russian humiliation by showing Americans it is at least doing something. What the columnist said. It's true that sending in a limited number of troops is just the illusion of action, said David Rothkopf in Foreign Policy, but it makes some political sense. This step signals to Putin and his allies that the U.S. is willing to get involved and that the conflict in Syria may grow more complex for them, giving the U.S. more leverage in the multi-party peace talks. Actually, the president is backing himself into a proxy war he can only lose, said Michael Brendan Doherty in TheWeek.com. Our supposed allies, the moderate rebels, have almost no chance of winning, while Russia is backing the one faction that has the strength to emerge victorious, the Assad regime. Knowing he holds the upper hand, Putin can now raise the military ante until the U.S. eventually has to cut its loss in a humiliatingly public way. It isn't fair to say Obama lacks a strategy, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. He's hoping to solidify Syria's rough partition into four zones, held by Assad, the Kurds, ISIS, and a patchwork of rebel groups. That might then convince all sides except ISIS that the war has reached a stalemate and that the only path forward is a serious negotiation. Whatever its strategic wisdom, Obama's decision is flagrantly unconstitutional, said Connor Friedersdorf in TheAtlantic.com. Ludicrously, Obama is claiming the right to send troops to Syria to fight ISIS under congressional authorization passed in 2001 to pursue the perpetrators of 9/11. Commanders-in-chief can't wage war unilaterally. If ISIS is worth fighting, Obama should make that case as persuasively as he can, and then abide by the course set by the people's representatives. Our controversy of the week, the debates. Is the media biased against Republicans? The biggest loser of last week's GOP debate in Colorado wasn't a candidate, said Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. It was the media. For two painful-to-watch hours, three smarmy moderators from a CNBC badgered the candidates with hostile and insulting questions in one of the most blatant demonstrations of liberal media bias ever witnessed. The moderators asked Donald Trump if he's running a comic book version of a presidential campaign, mocked Senator Marco Rubio as a young man in a hurry to become president, and questioned whether Ben Carson had math skills. Senator Ted Cruz earned wild applause from the Republican audience when he blasted the moderators for ignoring substantive issues and trying to turn the candidates against one another in a political cage match. CNBC's widely panned debacle may mark a turning point in these political debates, said Ed Rogers in WashingtonPost.com. Even though the campaigns couldn't agree on a list of conditions for future debate questions, this is the last time the grandstanding liberal media will feel free to belittle and demean Republican candidates. What nonsense, said Brian Beutler in NewRepublic.com. The CNBC moderators may have lost control of the debate at times, but the questions they asked were extremely substantive. Trump was asked to explain how he planned to fulfill his promise to deport 11 million illegal immigrants and force Mexico to pay for a 1,900-mile-long wall at the border. Carson was asked to explain the mathematical reasoning behind the flat 10% tax rate he's proposed, which will cut federal revenues by an insane 50%. The real problem for the GOP candidates is not media bias, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. It's that their policy proposals are so truly bizarre and indefensible that simply to ask questions about them in any serious way seems like a vicious attack. Republicans have been accusing the media of bias since the 1970s, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. But let's examine Cruz's assertion that Democrats got softball questions during their debate. The first question to Hillary Clinton accused her of repeatedly flip-flopping for political expediency and concluded, "Will you say anything to get elected?" Bernie Sanders was asked, "How can any kind of socialist win a general election?" As for CNBC's supposed liberal bias, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com, it's a relentlessly pro-business network, and one of its anchors, Rick Santelli, launched the Tea Party movement during a live broadcast. The chorus of manufactured outrage about last week's debate is a charade designed to fire up the Republican base while intimidating all future moderators into not doing their job, which is to ask questions that put the candidates on the spot. Tough questions are fine, said Timothy Carney in WashingtonExaminer.com. But in a Republican debate, those questions need to come from a conservative perspective. It's undeniable that most mainstream journalists are liberals, so even when they try to moderate a debate fairly, they ask how a candidate's tax cuts will be paid for, rather than how he or she will cut spending, an unthinkable concept for liberals. Republican candidates should be answering questions that matter to constituents rather than Beltway Democrats posing as journalists, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. That said, the news networks should also reject any attempt by the candidates to transform GOP debates into infomercials. If the current flap results in candidates getting veto power over the format, so that they get to make self-serving opening and closing statements and face only softball questions, it will be bad news for voters. Well, it was a good week for a penny saved after Otha Anders, a school teacher in Louisiana, cashed in his collection of more than 500,000 pennies, which he'd been gathering for the past 45 years. The coins weighed nearly 3,000 pounds and were worth $5,136.14. It was a good week for Rent a Mom after a Brooklyn woman began renting mothering services to needy hipsters. For $40 per hour, Nina Kennelly will cook meals, go shopping, or offer guilt-free motherly advice to millennials. Everybody needs a mom now and then, Kennelly said, but maybe not his or her own mom. It was a good week for staying one step ahead of the law after a Georgia man facing 20 years in prison on fraud charges fled the courthouse in panic moments before the jury declared him not guilty. I felt kind of stupid, said Saladin Ghani after learning of the verdict. But it was a bad week for economists after researchers at the Federal Reserve found that the results of two-thirds of economic studies cannot be replicated, suggesting that the dismal science is not very scientific. It was a bad week for make-believe after Los Angeles movie theaters announced that masks and simulated weapons such as lightsabers would not be allowed at screenings of the new Star Wars sequel. Movie theater attacks have left theater owners and patrons very nervous. And it was a bad week for a fresh start after incoming Speaker of the House Paul Ryan revealed that he is working on ways to detoxify his new office from the smell of cigarettes left behind by his predecessor, John Boehner. You know, if you ever go in a hotel room or a rental car that's been smoked in, Ryan said, that's what this smells like. We're on the briefing page now. The coming virtual revolution. Tech companies say virtual reality is about to change the world. Will it live up to the hype? What is virtual reality? It's a technology that transports users into three-dimensional, 360-degree virtual worlds that feel real. By donning a headset, you are immersed in a rich, stereoscopic, and responsive environment that tricks the visual cortex into believing what it sees. Turn your head, and your view shifts. A number of VR headsets are expected to go on sale to the public in a matter of months. The most hyped is Facebook's Oculus Rift, but at least three other tech giants, Google, Sony, and Samsung, are pouring billions of dollars into their own ambitious virtual reality projects. In the near future, users could put on one of these headsets and find themselves lying on the sands of an exotic beach, standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon, or chasing bad guys through the streets of virtual cities. This is the first time that we've succeeded in stimulating parts of the human visual system directly, said virtual reality engineer Michael Abrash. I don't get vertigo when I watch a video of the Grand Canyon on TV, but I do when I stand on a ledge in VR. Hasn't this technology been tried before? Yes, virtual reality enjoyed a brief heyday in the 1990s, but the headsets proved too bulky and the graphics too crude and clunky. Motion sickness was also a major problem. The on-screen graphics couldn't keep pace with the VR user's head movements, and that tiny but perceptible delay, known as latency, created a powerful nausea that turned people off. But thanks to massive progress in mobile computing, headsets are now lightweight and latency is down to just 20 milliseconds. That means no more motion sickness, plus a more immersive experience. I describe it as visceral, said British psychologist Dr. Ashley Conway, after using a VR headset to ride a virtual roller coaster. You feel your stomach lurch, even though there is a part of your brain telling you that this is an illusion. How will we use virtual reality? Proponents of the technology say that some workers will no longer need to commute to a physical office and could instead pop on a headset and telecommute into a virtual meeting with colleagues. At home, people could use VR headsets to scroll through their social media feeds and jump right into a friend's video and feel as if they were actually there. Microsoft is working on a connected technology known as augmented reality that superimposes high-definition holograms on real-life rooms. Wearing one of the company's HoloLens headsets, you could soon sit next to a virtual puppy on your real-life living room sofa while watching a movie on your hologram big-screen TV. But VR technology isn't just for entertainment. It's already being put to more serious uses, such as... Psychologists are currently testing VR headsets on patients with severe phobias and social anxieties. Patients with a crippling fear of heights, for example, can practice standing at the top of a virtual skyscraper without ever leaving the doctor's office. Through VR, veterans with PTSD can revisit a traumatic wartime event, a process that experts say can aid recovery. Surgeons use virtual reality to practice rare and difficult procedures before performing them on actual patients, while NGOs have produced VR fundraising documentaries that allow potential donors to walk around Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, after the recent devastating earthquake, or experience life inside a Syrian refugee camp. The technology, says filmmaker Chris Milk, could become a powerful tool for charities. There's something about sitting on the same ground someone else is sitting on, he says, that changes the way your brain registers humanity. Could VR make us even more screen obsessed? That's a genuine concern. Several World of Warcraft gamers have committed suicide or collapsed in recent years after playing the popular video game for 20 hours straight or longer. Such incidents could become more common if VR allows gamers to effectively live in an imaginary interactive land. Virtual reality could even result in non-gamers shutting themselves off from the outside world, warned Stanford University psychiatrist Dr. Elias Abujudi. To some degree, this has already happened with the internet, Abujudi told The Atlantic. We may stop needing or craving real social interactions because we are so immersed in virtual life. Is that likely to occur? In the long run, perhaps, but not at this stage. Virtual reality still needs a lot of work before it becomes truly, and perhaps dangerously, immersive. The next generation of VR headsets won't engage senses other than sight and hearing, so users won't feel the heat of the sun while they walk along a virtual beach or smell the sea air. And for the next few years, VR headsets will only work when hooked up to an expensive gaming PCs or consoles, limiting the number of potential buyers, at least for now. But in our hectic and often stressful lives, the pure escapism of virtual reality could ensure the technology's success. After a hard day at work, you could relax by putting on a headset and immersing yourself in a favorite vacation video. Who wouldn't want to do that, asked Chris Dixon of Andreessen Horowitz, a venture capital firm that has invested in Oculus Rift. In some ways, the biggest competitor to virtual reality might be a bottle of wine. Taking a look at the columns now. The first from the U.S., why taxes must go up, not down. Despite what both Republican and Democratic presidential candidates are telling voters, said Robert Samuelson, there is no tooth fairy. Republicans running for president have proposed huge across-the-board tax cuts, insisting that the trillions in lost revenue will be magically offset by the economic growth stimulated by the cuts. But even after accepting optimistic assumptions about additional growth, the Nonpartisan Tax Foundation predicts that all the Republican tax plans will still cut federal revenues by $1.6 trillion to $10 trillion over a decade. How can the federal government absorb such losses at the same time it's being hit with the baby boomers' soaring Social Security and Medicare costs? It can't. Democrats, meanwhile, propose paying the nation's bills and alleviating economic inequality by soaking the rich. But even if the top tax rate were raised from 39.6% to 50%, it would generate only $100 billion in annual tax revenues, hardly enough to lift millions of Americans out of poverty or keep entitlement programs intact. No one is telling middle-class Americans the truth. If they want to preserve the benefits they currently enjoy, sooner or later, a tax increase is coming their way. This from the United Kingdom. Why Europe so despises America? Anti-Americanism in Europe isn't rational, said Justin Webb. The Europeans who act as if the only nuclear weapons are housed in the Pentagon, the only executions take place in Texas, and the only war crimes are those perpetrated by Americans, will tell you that their antipathy is rooted in policy disputes. If only the U.S. would change its evil ways, they say, their hatred would disappear. In fact, anti-Americanism was invented long before the United States existed. During the colonial era, visitors to America reported back that the place was a dump, rife with putrefaction because of a climate too humid for life to thrive. American culture was seen as degenerate and decaying from the very start. But over the centuries, that culture has wormed its way into European societies through movies, music, and literature, a kind of cultural seduction that is worse than imperial takeover. Seduction makes you feel weak, so you hate your seducer as well as yourself. Anti-Americanism, then, is a form of self-loathing. The more we become like America, the more we despise it, particularly for the needy, wheedling way Americans seem to want to be loved. There's simply no cure. Even profound changes in foreign policy are unlikely to counter this deep-seated disgust. And this from China, the end of the one-child policy. Demographics have finally caught up with China's one-child policy, said South China Morning Post in an editorial. Since the late 1970s, China has allowed urban couples to have one child and rural couples to have two, so long as their firstborn was a girl. Because of a traditional preference for sons, women often abort female fetuses, skewing China's sex ratio to 118 boys for every 100 girls. China today faces the prospect of millions of men without women, and children without siblings, aunts, or uncles. But that's not why the Communist Party announced last week that it would start allowing every couple to have two kids. The reason is China's rapidly graying population. By 2053, over 65s will make up 35% of the population, about 487 million people. And the country simply doesn't have enough young workers to support them. The policy was castigated and cursed for quite a long time, but it achieved its original goal, said the Global Times. Population growth has been contained for three decades, allowing the government to better allocate resources and lift millions of Chinese out of poverty. China's economic takeoff would not have been possible if everyone had large families. Yet the cost has been so much loneliness, said Shen Wan in China Daily. Like many of my peers, deep in my heart, I always longed for a sister. As a reporter, I've talked to numerous couples who ache for the children they never had. One mother who lost her adult son in a car accident spoke tearfully of the second child she aborted, who would have been there to comfort her. Families need children to live and prosper, and so do nations. But don't expect a baby boom, said Mu Gangsong, also in China Daily. Raising an entire generation under the one-child policy has changed Chinese society. Many young women now prioritize their careers over starting a family, and parents with one child are leery of taking on the huge cost of a second. When Beijing changed the policy in 2013 to allow couples to have two children if one of the parents was an only child, it expected that 2 million couples would apply, but only 1.1 million did. And because some 60% of Chinese women of childbearing age today are over 35, many may not be able to conceive a second child, even if they desperately want one. In fact, this change in policy may be too little too late, said Verna Yu in South China Morning Post. The government expects at most an additional 3 million births a year, which won't be nearly enough to reverse the rapid aging of the population, or to reach a fertility rate of replacement level. China will soon be a nation of elderly people, and it will be the state, not families, that will have to take care of them. And now to the last word. The hunt for a $1 billion apple. The Timothy apple could transform the U.S. cider market, said Christopher Hughes. If only it could be found. The best apple you've never had is out there, somewhere. It's not the tough and tangy Granny Smith. It's not the Honeycrisp, the de rigueur dessert apple of the 21st century. And it's definitely not that rubbery red delicious loitering year-round in your supermarket produce aisle. Instead, this transcendent orb is unassuming, mottled, and misshapen. Its flesh dense and mouth-puckering, what orchardists affectionately refer to as a spitter. But when pressed and fermented, it could blossom into liquid gold. With time and expertise, its nectar could become as layered and as nuanced as the great wines of France's Loire Valley. At least that's what Shaxbury co-founder and cider maker Colin Davis is telling me as we careen around blind corners and gun down half-finished roads in Cornwall, Vermont, a rural hamlet 40 miles south of Burlington. For years, Davis has been consumed by the hunt for a possibly apocryphal apple known as the Timuth, or Tinmouth, excuse me. In the 1905 book, The Apples of New York, still considered the Bible for self-proclaimed apple geeks like Davis, legendary horticulturist Spencer Ambrose Beach described the Tinmouth as sprightly and peculiar tasting. But today, that vague characterization is all that remains of the forgotten fruit. About a century ago, it mysteriously vanished from New England and therefore from the world. Finding the Tinmouth and other lost species of cider apples is a large part of Shaxbury's business. As Davis steers us through fields of sugar maples and other deciduous trees, it's hard to make out anything distinguishable in the gnarled overgrowth, let alone a grubby golf ball-sized apple. We've been here once before. About a month ago, Davis brought me along with a small group of friends to a hidden, overgrown grove of wild apples, located deep in the woods on private land, that looks suspiciously like Tinmouths. We have no idea if we'll be able to find it again, but this time Davis has brought reinforcements. Hard cider is the fastest growing category of alcoholic beverage in the United States. It's projected to become a billion-dollar industry within the next several years. Until now, most of that growth has been driven by mass appeal mega brands such as Woodchuck and Boston Beer Company's Angry Orchard, which tend to favor saccharine ciders made from common dessert apples like the Macintosh. Despite the lure of easy profit, Davis and his business partner, David Dolganow, have never tried to capitalize on the lucrative sweet cider trend. Instead, they've embarked on a far more ambitious, if not chaotic, quest for perfection. Their goal with Shaxbury and with the company's offshoot, the Lost Apple Project, is essentially to bring America's greatest apples back from the dead, scouring Vermont roadsides and pastures for forgotten strains that once lined the roads of colonial New England. Like Sangiovese grapes in Tuscany or Pinot Noir in Burgundy, apples such as the Tinmouth typically thrive in a single region. That's why Dolganow sees New England and its once vaunted concentration of the world's greatest apples as potentially the cider-making equivalent of Napa Valley. It's difficult to fathom how important the apple was to early America. Today, industrial-scale farming has squelched biodiversity so that the broader market is dominated by just six varieties: Red Delicious, Golden Delicious, Gala, Fuji, Granny Smith, and Macintosh. But in the 18th and 19th centuries, American nurseries cataloged more than 16,000 different named apples and as many as 7,500 American varieties. Apple trees were everywhere, particularly in New England, where they were used to mark property lines. Sugar was still a luxury good then, and apples sated the colonist's sweet tooth. But far more important, most apples were grown to make America's national beverage, hard cider. Up until Prohibition, Michael Pollan wrote in The Botany of Desire, in rural areas, cider took the place not only of wine and beer, but of coffee and tea, juice, and even water. It's easy to see why. Until the 1900s, most water was contaminated with bacteria. Beyond issues of sanitation, cider was America's homegrown answer to wine. Our native grapes weren't sweet enough to ferment. And just like European wines, American ciders could be incredibly complex, even nuanced. That's why Thomas Jefferson grew cider apples at Monticello, where Hughes crabs are kept to this day. Cider, not snacking, was the real reason John Chapman, better known as Johnny Appleseed, was flinging seeds and setting up nurseries through the Ohio Valley and the Midwest in the early 1800s. Growing apples is easy, but cultivating a tree that bears palatable fruit is rare. Most of the chance seedlings that germinated in Chapman's wake weren't fit for his tin pot hat, but they were plenty suited for a decent coif or even a nip of Applejack. In fact, Chapman couldn't possibly have known what he was growing. Apples are extremely heterozygous, meaning each seed contains the genetic makeup for a completely new and different type of apple tree. If you were to plant a seed from a Macintosh apple, the one thing you could be sure of is that the sapling it produced wouldn't be a Macintosh tree. That's why apple farmers focus on the stem, not the seed. When Shaxbury growers find a choice wildling, a wild apple tree, out of the brush that they want to duplicate, they have to cut a scion, a branch with buds, and graft it onto the rootstock of an existing apple tree. This is essentially the art of cloning. The technique hasn't changed significantly in hundreds of years, and it requires a skill that even today wows its practitioners. The fact that you can take one stick, wrap it in grafting putty to this other stick, and they grow together, it's a tiny miracle, Dolgonow says. Early colonists had the foresight to bring over scions of their favorite European trees, but many of the grafts failed in the harsh New England climate. The millions of seeds they planted, on the other hand, flourished in their new home. Some 7,500 new varieties took root, several times what Europe had produced in 3,000 years of cultivation. In the colonies, apple farmers identified the best of the new seedling trees, then grafted and propagated them in nurseries. The first of these distinguished new American cultivars, the Roxbury Russet, was discovered just outside of Boston in 1645. Thanks to a perfect storm of seed and soil, the golden age of apples had arrived. By the mid-19th century, Americans were achieving fame and fortune just by finding the next Red Delicious or Grimes Golden. It was an era some called, appropriately, the Great Apple Rush. Unfortunately for the apple, the rush didn't last. Soon, beer and wine surged in popularity. Prohibitionist Kerry Nation's hatchet came calling, and grocery chains began demanding monocropped uniformity. By the time Prohibition ended in 1933, the apple had been reduced to a few baking varieties, the sweetest, shiniest, most lipstick red among the thousands. Elevated by industrial demand, these dessert apples choked out some of the most exquisite cider apples ever recorded. Unique specimens that could only thrive in New England were driven to the brink of extinction. In places like rural Vermont, a few hardy stragglers were swallowed up again by the forest, forgotten except for their names. Apple foragers rely on a combination of rough forensic evidence, historical data, some of it available only in ancient nursery catalogs, old newspaper articles, books like Beach's out-of-print tome, and even some educated word of mouth. It's more Sherlock Holmes than James Watson. As it happens, word of mouth is why we're racing around Ten Mouth today on 500 idyllic acres owned by Adam Guettel, an ardent conservationist and Tony Award-winning composer and lyricist. His grandfather was Richard Rodgers of the Rodgers and Hammerstein fame. The tip, Guettel told us, came from a Washington Irving-type character named Marshall Squire, a local farmer whose family had been in Ten Mouth for generations. Squire believes that the town's once famous apple resides somewhere in a wild orchard on Guettel's land. Ryan Yoder, a wild-eyed farmer from neighboring Danby, has heard the rumors as well. 5 years ago, he spotted some feral trees on the Ten Mouth property, then spent more than a year tracking Guettel down in Manhattan, hoping to harvest the fruit for his cider vinegar business. He's been here before and hopefully can lead us back to the old orchard. And this time out, Davis has brought along Windfall Orchard's Brad Kohler. A sweet cider maker and horticulturalist, Kohler grows dozens of ancient heirloom varieties in Cornwall, including one called the Windfall Golden. After about 30 minutes, we come across our first stand of unpruned apple trees, and our ragtag party begins picking samples from the rough rows of budding fruit. Tasting is a major step in identifying wild trees, so no branch goes unplucked. Yoder bites into a particularly vegetal sample that smacks of asparagus and immediately spits it out, chucking the half-eaten orb into the brush. Tree after tree reveals some variation of a Macintosh or Rhode Island greening. Good apples on any other day. But Kohler, our resident expert, is growing increasingly frustrated. This is why they say in our field that finding an apple like the Tin Mouth is a 10,000-to-1 proposition, he said. It almost never happens. Ahead in the distance, we hear Yoder hollering, "This way!" And the rest of the party takes off in a dead sprint. Davis and I find our way blocked by a wall of vegetation so dense and nettlesome that it seems impenetrable without some sort of heavy machinery. After squirming through a brambly tunnel, we emerge into a muddy, blue-black clearing. Even on a sunny August afternoon, the panorama is shadowy, hushed, and cool. Errant shafts of sunlight break through the foliage high overhead, framing a tree larger than any of the others we've seen on Goodall's property. Its brawny trunk looks like three trees entwined as one. "This is the old orchard I was telling about, you guys," Yoder says. Kohler spots one of the few apples at eye level and gingerly extracts it, careful not to let it escape into the dead foliage crackling beneath his feet. "This is definitely the most promising thing we've seen all day," he says. "See how it has a matte finish and just a little bit of russeting?" He pierces the apple with his front incisors and shuts his eyes in contemplation. Then he takes another bite and another until he's gnawing it to the core. "The flavor seems right," he cheers. Yoder and Davis immediately drop to their knees and begin searching the underbrush for their own tin mouth as Kohler barks at us to find more specimens. But all of them appear to be dangling about two stories above our heads. Overjoyed as a prospector in sight of gold, Yoder shimmies up the tree and steadies himself on a high branch. The limb groans under his weight, showering loose bark and debris. He crawls on his belly to a small parcel of apples and carefully shakes them free. We scramble for the fallen apples. This is the moment we've all been waiting for. But no sooner do I bite into mine than Kohler lets out a devastated sigh. He's found the faintest streak of pink curving down the shoulder of one of the tree's apples. For a few pained seconds, we all stare at one another, slack-jawed and confused. "What?" Davis asks. Kohler breaks the damning news. Regardless of the season, the tin mouth would never have a hue other than green or yellow. The silence is palpable. I watch as Yoder, Kohler, and finally Shaxberry, founders, slowly walk single file out of the secret garden until we find ourselves at the base of the hill, peering up at the red barn where our journey began. "So how disappointed are you?" I ask. Davis shields his eyes from the punishing sun and looks back at me with his toothy, infectious smile. "Oh, we'll keep looking," he says. "The search will never end." This was first published in Boston Magazine, October 2015. We'll take in one of the obituaries this week. The Hollywood actor who became a U.S. Senator. Fred Thompson, 1942 to 2015. Fred Thompson succeeded in almost everything he tried. He was an accomplished lawyer who played a key role in the Senate Watergate hearings. He starred in movies alongside Paul Newman and Clint Eastwood. He was twice elected to the U.S. Senate. But there was one job Thompson couldn't land, the presidency. His thwarted campaign as a Republican candidate in the 2008 presidential race was, he later admitted, his first real failure. I had more to be humble about than I realized, he said. It was a pretty doggone expensive way to achieve a little humility. Thompson grew up in the small town of Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, where he was a top athlete and his father sold used cars, said the New York Times. After training as a lawyer, he began his life in public service at age 30, when his mentor, Senator Howard Baker, chose him to serve as Republican counsel on a Senate Watergate committee. It was Thompson's tough questioning of Alexander Butterfield, a former aide to President Nixon, that led to the revelation of recording devices in the Oval Office, a turning point in the investigation that ended in the president's resignation. Once the committee had finished its work, Thompson embarked on a lucrative legal and lobbying career. He became a successful character actor after playing himself in the 1985 movie Marie, said The Guardian, based on a case in which he represented a whistleblower who exposed corruption in the government of Tennessee. That led to a string of small parts in other films, including 1989's Fat Man and Little Boy with Newman and 1993's In the Line of Fire with Eastwood. In 1994, Thompson won the special election for Vice President Al Gore's old Senate seat after crisscrossing Tennessee in a red pickup truck, said the Associated Press. He won re-election 2 years later and served a full 6-year term before leaving his seat for a part in the TV show Law and Order, a role he kept until his failed presidential bid. A respected member of Congress, Thompson found politics frustrating. After spending time in Washington, he once joked, "I often long for the realism and sincerity of Hollywood." Turning to the health and science page, first, we have the toxic toll of too much sugar. It's common knowledge that eating too much sugar loads the body with empty calories and leads to weight gain. But a new study suggests this sweet staple of the American diet isn't merely fattening, it's toxic. The problem lies in the way the body breaks down sucrose, fructose, and other simple carbohydrates. Sugar calories are the worst because they turn to fat in the liver, driving insulin resistance and driving risk for diabetes and heart and liver disease, explains endocrinologist Robert Lustig, the study's lead author. To isolate sugar's effect, Lustig and his team asked dietitians to change the meal plans of 43 obese children, maintaining the same total calories consumed, but substituting starchy processed carbohydrates for foods with added sugars. The kids traded pastries and yogurt for bagels and baked potato chips, limiting added sugar to just 10% of their daily calories. Within 9 days, the children's blood sugar levels had fallen by more than 50%, and their levels of triglycerides, a type of fat that travels in the blood and contributes to heart disease, had dropped by 33%. Their bad cholesterol level was also lower, and they had less fat on their livers. The researchers say their findings demonstrate that excessive sugar consumption can increase the risk of metabolic syndrome, a cluster of conditions that increase the risk for heart disease, diabetes, and stroke. Up until now, there have been a lot of correlation studies linking sugar and metabolic syndrome, Lustig tells Time.com. This is causation. Africa's disappearing lions. When an American big game hunter killed Zimbabwe's beloved lion Cecil earlier this year, the animal's death shone a spotlight on an unfolding tragedy. Lions are quickly disappearing from the African landscape, not simply because of poorly regulated hunting, but because of poaching, widespread habitat loss, and a shortage of prey. Within the next two decades, most lion populations will shrink by 50%, new research reveals. A lot of the African bush is now silent of the lion's roar, ecologist Luke Hunter, the study's co-author, tells LiveScience.com. We're losing that characteristic emblem of African wilderness. After tracking 8,221 lions at 47 different populations across Africa, researchers found two-thirds of the populations are in decline, most notably in West and Central Africa. The majestic cats fare better in the heavily protected reserves of Southern Africa, but researchers believe more conservation efforts are needed to ensure their survival in the wild, which has wide implications. The lion plays a pivotal role as the continent's top carnivore, Hunter warns. And the free fall of Africa's lion populations we are seeing today could inexorably change the landscape of Africa's ecosystem. On the Talking Points page, Obamacare. The young aren't buying. Young people are smarter than the Obama administration had hoped, said Andy Puzder in the Wall Street Journal. For the Affordable Care Act to work, millions of healthy adults under 35 without health insurance will have to buy coverage on the exchanges, offsetting the cost of insuring older, sicker enrollees. But in 2015, 6.6 million millennials chose to accept the tax penalty, as little as $325, rather than pay for a policy they didn't really want. Young people know that if they fall ill or break a leg, they can still get treatment at an emergency room. And they can always buy insurance after they get sick, because Obamacare forbids the denial of coverage for pre-existing conditions. As a result, the administration now admits enrollments in the exchanges are expected to creep up from 9 million people in 2015 to just 10 million people next year, less than half the original projection of 21 million. Meanwhile, premiums have risen an average 7.5%, spiking as much as 35% in some states. For many working Americans, that isn't affordable care. That's only a small part of the picture, said Jonathan Cohn in HuffingtonPost.com. For the 2 years after the law took effect, many insurers knowingly set premiums unrealistically low in order to grab customers, even if it meant losses in the short term. We're seeing a price correction now, which should level off after a year. Most people who've been hit with premium increases can still find cheaper alternatives if they go shopping on the exchanges. Meanwhile, the great majority of the still uninsured, with incomes below $46,000 for singles and $94,000 for a family of four, can benefit from subsidies that can reduce premiums by hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars a year. But the number of people who need these subsidies is double what the administration predicted, said Brian Blaze in Forbes.com. Right now, they're the only ones who generally find ACA plans worth their cost, and that doesn't bode well for Obamacare's future sustainability. Is this a disaster? Not yet, says Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com. Obamacare is still in an early phase, and it's possible young uninsureds will sign up in coming years as they learn more about the program and the tax penalty gets larger. We don't know what the mature program will look like, and won't know for at least three more years. And a few of the short notes here on the Talking Points page. Late-in-life divorces are becoming more common. The divorce rate for people age 50 and over doubled from 1990 to 2014, even while the rate for younger people was dropping. With life expectancies rising, said sociologist Pepper Schwartz, A lot of people in their 50s and 60s with unsatisfying marriages are saying, do I really want 30 more years of this? The International Space Station marked its 15th year of continuous residency this week. During that time, the ISS has hosted 220 astronauts representing 17 countries, and more than 400 experiments have been conducted, many of them on the effect of prolonged weightlessness on the human body. Since 2004, at least 10 Americans have been accidentally shot by dogs. The latest canine shooting occurred in Indiana last week when a woman left her loaded shotgun on the ground and her dog, Trigger, stood on it, blasting her in the left foot. The Department of Defense spent nearly $43 million of taxpayers' money building a single gas station in Afghanistan, 140 times more than it should have cost, according to a government watchdog. Even considering security costs, said an official report, this level of expenditure appears gratuitous and extreme. On the poll watch, Americans are becoming less religious. 77% of Americans say they are religiously affiliated, down from 83% in 2007. 63% of Americans say they're absolutely certain that God exists, down from 71% in 2007. These trends are most pronounced among millennials. And we'll finish today with a quote from one of my favorite authors, Kurt Vonnegut. Practice any art, no matter how well or badly, not to get money and fame, but to experience becoming, to find out what's inside you, to make your soul grow. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.